Welcome to Media Path. I'm Louise Palenker.
And I'm Fritz Coleman.
This week, we are heading up the path called stand-up comedy. It's a route often traveled by me and well-traveled by Fritz. Our guest is stand-up comic Ivan Dekker. Ivan is a Canadian-born comic who is taking the States by storm, and we will be speaking with him very shortly. First, Fritz, what are you recommending?
Funny dude. Can't wait to talk to him.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I looked into another music documentary, and MGM Plus is my new hobby.
Yes.
It's called In Restless Dreams, The Music of Paul Simon. It's a two-parter about one of the greatest songwriters in music history. The arc of the two parts is Paul working on his latest album, his first in 20 years, called Seven Psalms. The concept of this album came to Paul in a dream. The dream said, you're going to be working on a project called Seven Psalms. All he had to start with was a riff on an acoustic guitar. Then he played it over and over again and gradually built out the music and the lyrics. He worked on this album in his home in Wimberley, Texas. He moved there because his wife, musician Edie Brickell of Edie Brickell and the New Bohemians, was born and raised not far away. It's a small cabin in the middle of a field. You would not believe it. There is no way you would look at this place and decide it was the residence of one of America's great songwriters. It's filled with eclectic mixes of exotic instruments that he uses on the recording of Seven Psalms. He's got this thing called a cloud chamber bowl, I don't know what that is, and a glockenspiel. Now, the first half, or what they call the first verse of this documentary, is the early years, becoming the global phenomenon known as Simon and Garfunkel. Early influences, early friendship with Artie that went on since they were 10 years old. How their music became the soundtrack of The Graduate is an interesting story, and sort of random, and includes Mike Nichols. The first act culminates with Simon and Garfunkel coming apart. Art Garfunkel was starting to act, first in Catch-22 and then in Carnal Knowledge. Art got to the point where he wanted Paul to create all the songs and just call me when you're ready to record. Paul was dissatisfied with that arrangement. So Bridge Over Troubled Water, a story about friendship and love and helping someone in need through a tough time, became their last song together. Kind of poignant. Eventually, they would reunite for a concert in Central Park that drew 500,000 people. It will give you goosebumps. The second verse, the second chapter, as the sections are called, is about Paul's solo career and the 15 albums it produced. This half was most interesting to me because over and above his contribution to the American Songbook, Paul was the first artist to introduce world music to a global audience. There are clips from his concert in Zimbabwe with Hugh Masekela and Miriam Makeba. Now, Hugh and Miriam are South African. At that time, though, there was a moratorium on relations with South Africa because of apartheid. So it was an act of protest for him to perform with them. And South Africans actually ran across the South Africa-Zimbabwe border to see this concert and experience a taste of musical freedom. Then he moved to include Brazilian artists in his concerts and his recording. His most famous work using international talent was Graceland, which used African musicians, including Ladysmith Black Mambazo. He was a pioneer in global music. What you will probably come away with, though, and because of my age, this is what I came away with. This is an 82-year-old man coming to terms with still being creative while coming to terms with his age-related frailties, his hearing loss, his voice, which is no longer the clear as a bell high tenor. But in his brilliant soul, he still has a lot to share. It's a wonderful series. The second act, the second verse, as they say, just dropped last week, and it's up now on MGM Plus.
I'd love to talk about this more once I finish it. For
yeah, you got
to.
You'll eat it up.
I adore Paul Simon. I'm halfway through the first episode. It's extraordinary, and I've read a lot of books about Paul Simon, so mm-hmm. It's like sort of like watching the books come to life. Everything yeah. I know about him and mm-hmm. in visual form with people speaking, mm-hmm. it's just fantastic. But I do have a Paul Simon story.
Let's hear it.
So it's 1986. Graceland has just come out. And my coworker, Tony Hudson, and I go over to the Beverly Hills Hotel where Paul Simon is in a bungalow, and we interview him. And it was a beautiful experience because I've loved Paul Simon my whole life. So I get to speak with him. You know, as you see in this piece, he's extraordinarily eloquent. Just watching him and Wynton Marsalis together, I really would just sit and watch them on a stage have a conversation for hours. So I'm talking to Paul Simon, and he's saying, "Well, what do you want to do?" And I said, well, you know, I'd kind of like to be a comedy writer. And he asked me, you know, if I was familiar with Lorne Michaels. Like, and yes, and I know he's your best friend. Like, yes, yes, and yes. Anyway, I get back to the to Kiss FM, and Bruce Vidal is on the air. Mm-hmm. He calls me into the studio, and he said, there's a message for you. Paul Simon called the studio looking for you. This is Lorne Michaels' address, and this is where you send all of your comedy.
Wow.
All of your comedy samples.
That's so cool. And Justin, you never get a follow-up like that in show business.
No, and that's how sweet he is, and that's wow. A kind, thoughtful person.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I mean, you hear sort of varying stories about him. There's an episode in there where he meets Edie Brickell, and he met her because she was performing on Saturday Night Live, and Paul was one of the recurring guests early in the history of that,
oh, yeah.
And it was so good.
Yeah.
He was so good. I loved the flavor of the show in the early years.
Yeah.
And how they met, and Edie said, I was warned against dating this man. They said, don't date this man, he's crazy. And, you know, because he'd been with Carrie Fisher and a few other people. And I didn't get any sense of that in this film. He was such a sensitive man. You can tell that his gift is like divine intervention.
Absolutely.
Coming from another place.
Absolutely.
And it's beautiful. I can't wait for you to see
it. I think he's aware of that, and he honors that, and he gives it its due course with yeah. respect and reverence.
Right, right.
And just a tremendous talent that
Absolutely.
We're graced to be on the planet mm-hmm. with him. So my pick this week is not as important, but I did have fun with it. Okay. So I have indulged my book-to-screen experience obsession, Fritz. It's called Apples Never Fall. It is a novel by Leanne Moriarty, which has been adapted into a Peacock miniseries. It stars Sam Neill and Annette Bening as the heads of a dysfunctional tennis family. Apples Never Fall is a murder mystery slash family drama focusing on the Delaneys, a tennis family. The parents, Joy and Stan, ran a well-known tennis academy where their four kids played and excelled. Each of them could have gone all the way to the pros, but didn't quite make it. After selling the business and retiring, Joy goes missing. So now let's investigate everyone's messy personal business in search of motive. And in a tennis family, or in any family where the children's personal worth is conditional, measured through the currency of victory, success, fame, grades, sports, etc., emotional stability in the grown-up version of the kid can be iffy. Tennis affords an especially binary outcome. Did you win or lose? Who can you beat? Who can beat you? What is your personal ranking? My parents had a snowbird home near the Nick Bollettieri Tennis Academy in Florida, and I witnessed these dynamics up close. It was exciting to watch how well the kids played, but talking to them one-on-one, you felt the loneliness, the isolation, the desperation for Nick's attention, their sense of self wrapped entirely in tennis. No one activity is more important than a socially and emotionally nurturing childhood. Leanne Moriarty writes brilliantly about these fraught elite tennis dynamics, and in this case, even more heightened when your father is the coach. How Stan's steely personality impacts his parenting and his marriage. She writes about the sacrifices women make to support a family's collective vision and what is lost and gained when siblings are all competing not only for parental love and attention, but also within the same athletic arena. I loved the book. It is focused around the four adult Delaney siblings as they learn that a stranger has moved in with their parents and is showing them up in the departments of engagement, interest, helpfulness, and cooking. Closely thereafter, their mother goes missing. The novel is absolutely packed with twists, surprises, intricate human truths, insightful observation, and intriguingly relatable family dynamics. So, do the apples of the series fall far from the tree of the book? Yes, and a few get away. Moriarty is Australian, and the book takes place in Sydney. The series is set in Florida, but it was filmed in Australia. There are a few key changes in plot and character. In fact, the series turns far enough away from the book to keep readers of the book guessing, and the actors are not elite enough athletes for close-ups of their tennis serves. But okay, Sam Neill, your forehand is looking strong. At the center of the story is this uncomfortable question. However dysfunctional your family, could you entertain the thought that your father may have murdered your mother? I am partway through the series, Fritz, and if there is a way to sign up for ad-free Peacock, please inbox me.
I wonder why they don't do that.
I'm not sure.
I saw her previous series, Nine Perfect Strangers.
Yes.
I had no idea what it was about.
What was going on?
It was wacky.
Yeah.
It was a wacky series, although Melissa McCarthy was in it, so you're always watching her, but I just didn't get it. I didn't get the point of it.
Right. Well, you will get the point of this one. It's mm-hmm. This is, I just told you the point.
But there are a couple of reasons to love this. First of all, I'm so happy for, you know, I love when seniors come into their full blossom later in their life. Annette Bening is cooking, you know, with her Oscar nomination and this thing. She seems to be getting a lot of
right.
work.
She's swimming. She's playing tennis. She's having an active. She must have the right sanitary napkin because she's able to do it all. So let's introduce Ivan. Ivan Decker is an award-winning stand-up comedian and writer known for his sharp, polished, and multi-layered observational comedy. His first comedy special, Underwater Scissors, is a part of the Comedians of the World collection on Netflix. He was named Comic to Watch at the New York Comedy Festival and made his U.S. TV debut on Conan. His first album, I Wanted to Be a Dinosaur, won a Juno Award. That is Canadian for Grammy. Ivan's new Netflix special is called Popcorn. Please welcome Ivan Decker.
Welcome, Ivan.
Hello. Oh, thank you so much for having me.
I have to ask you my first question. What does it feel like to perform 5 minutes of stand-up in front of Conan?
Oh, it's wild. Yeah, because he's there.
Yeah.
And so, like, you can kind of hear him laugh.
Wow.
If you get a laugh from him. And it's, like, very hard not to look over behind you. I was like, I need to focus forward, but I can tell.
But Conan's
like everything kind of relaxes at that point. You're like, okay, well, if he likes it,
yeah. Once you get your first Conan laugh, you're good, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So, Ivan, I'm a huge fan of yours. This has only lasted about a week, so I'm still in the first flush of this romance. But I got to tell you, your show, I didn't see the first Netflix special, but Popcorn is brilliant. I mean, there's not a dead nanosecond in your whole show. You have great energy. Your observations are just spot on. I'm a fan from now on. But I'm perplexed about one thing. How does a man with your sharp, almost genius wit develop in Ladner, British Columbia? Hell is that? And where does humor come from in Ladner?
Per capita, Canadians are funnier than Americans.
Oh, is that true?
Yes, because they have to stay indoors half the year and make... what are your theories? Are Canadians funnier than Americans?
Yeah, I mean, maybe. I don't know. I prefer American audiences. Don't tell the Canadians. I feel like Canadians, because they're all funny, like everybody's funny, they have a little bit less of a... they don't enjoy stand-up as much. I think maybe it's a harder audience, so maybe that's why it's so fun for me to get to tour now, because I came up in such a tough environment. The audiences were traditionally pretty hard, and I started out doing a lot of bar shows and stuff like that. And so.
But that's interesting, because I was talking about, are they funnier as humans? And you were thinking, are they an easier audience to, will they laugh easily, but they don't laugh as easily because they're funny?
Yeah, I think that's my theory.
Yeah.
Because
I don't know
they're
if it's
cold.
True or not. Yeah.
You know, I started stand up in a jazz club in Buffalo, New York, and we had this conduit, this feeder system of Canadian comics that came down from Yuck Yucks in Toronto. It was like a 2-hour drive, Jim Carrey and Howie Mandel. And they would come here and they would blow the roof off the place and then get in their Isuzu van and go back across the Peace Bridge and never be heard from again. I mean, they have some very skilled comics. And I'm wondering what you think is the cause of that. I mean, they have Second City. You have some... I'll give you my theory and you tell me if this is right. I think Canada, very much like San Francisco, is very supportive of the arts. And people can develop, and they're supported even at the early parts of their career. Do you agree with that?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I think having a good, strong support system for the arts is good. Even having art spaces, things, places people can go where artists can work, and you can earn enough money that you need to. You can just be an artist. You don't have to have another job, and so you can put your stuff, your energy, full time into your craft. I think one of the other theories, I agree with you on that, but another thing I find so interesting and unique about the Canadian system, especially back in those days, is I was so lucky to get to perform in a smaller sort of scene. And so I would have exposure to comedians who I wouldn't normally get to work with because they were so far advanced from me. Mm-hmm. But because the scene in Canada is relatively smaller, you get to see people like Jim Carrey and like the best of the best in Canada would just be at the club on the weekend, and you could go and watch them, and you could even be on the same show as them, which was incredible. Such a great learning experience for me.
Do you remember an early conversation with someone who was an idol of yours and how supportive they were towards your dreams?
I got to open for this comedian Jerry D, who was he's on that the Fox show Animal Control, and he's had a little bit of success, but he's originally from Canada. He had a sitcom up there as well, and he was a theater act early on, and he was sort of one of the first theater acts to take me on the road and get me to open in these big theaters and give me the opportunity to perform in that environment, which is so different than the bar shows and sort of Yuck Yuck's weekend club shows I was used to. And he was the one who sort of taught me about the difference in those rooms, in those spaces, and how the theater, you can do the same material, but you need to slow down. You need to alter your pace because it's a bigger room. You have to make sure the laughs make it all the way to the back and come back to the front again. And so having that timing and that pacing, I think, is something that I've always focused on for my whole career.
Culturally, there's not a big difference between Canada and the United States. It's not like you would go perform in England and you have to take out the words for, you know, you put in lift instead of elevator and all that kind of stuff. Am I right about that? Is there any cultural divide as topics for stand-up from Canada to the United States?
They have very different candy.
Yeah, different candy, different foods. There's a certain vocabulary I had to change. I had a joke about... I also had a joke about the metric system, which I had to take out when I moved down. And then even stuff about, there's just weird vocabulary that I didn't know that I was using, like saying washroom instead of restroom and saying parkade instead of parking garage. Oh. Just like little things that would kind of, because we don't have a noticeable accent like British acts. I think if someone has a British accent, they could say rubbish or trousers and people are like, oh, that's fine. I get it. But in Canada, it's like, hey, this guy talks like he's from Wisconsin, and then he said a weird word I don't understand. What's happening?
Right, especially if you're from Vancouver. Because if you're from Toronto, you have the bit of the a boot or...
Yes.
Yeah, because I grew up in Buffalo, and I went to camp in Canada. So people in Buffalo consider themselves to be sort of half Canadian.
Yes, pretty
usually
close.
Half your relatives...
I actually didn't go there until only a few years ago, and I loved it.
Oh, yeah,
there.
Buffalo... Yeah,
upstate New York is fantastic.
No, it's the same sensibility because we're cold most of the year. Most of the year we're cold, and then we're just excited to see anyone. So,
yeah, Vancouver is much more similar to Seattle, I find.
Yes,
sort of culturally, like we have that West Coast, like California. Even I found it easier to blend in than when I went to Toronto because we have that kind of West Coast laid back. We're the last time zone in the country, so we get everything last. We're like the younger brother.
Right.
By the time we get up, everybody on the East Coast is already drunk. So it's, it's a little different.
So what do people in Toronto, what do people in Ontario think of people from Vancouver? Like, what are the rivalries like?
I mean, it's funny because growing up, there's big sports rivalries, of course. Hockey, very, very popular. And so if you're from Vancouver, everybody kind of has this idea that Toronto, we're in this rivalry. And I thought this growing like the whole time until I went to Toronto for the first time and I talked to somebody. I was like, I'm from Vancouver. And they're like, oh, that's neat. And then I realized that like, oh, the rivalry is basically like we made it up and they don't even think about us at all.
I want to know if Canadians are prepared for the influx of immigrants from the United States if Donald Trump gets reelected.
No.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe.
Do you look at us like we're all nuts down here?
They're going to put up a wall. They're not going to take us.
Do they sit around the dining room table and just say, God bless those lovely people down there? What happened to them?
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit wild, too, because there's definitely some shift up here, too, because we get the same the news. We get the American media up here. And so you have a little bit of, there's pockets up here too. They're like, we want to join America. And I'm like, oh, okay, that's good
for you. Good luck with that. You have the CBC, which is, I guess, is kind of like British broadcasting. And you were on a show. Tell me about that show that used to be on. Was that a stand-up show or was it an acting thing of yours? I can't remember the name of it. I had it written down here somewhere.
Oh, was it The Debaters?
Yeah, The Debaters. Was that all stand-ups?
Yeah, so it started off as stand-ups and improvs. It was such a great idea. And it's one of the most successful radio programs in the country. It's such a great writing exercise. And I think it sort of formed my stand-up too, because it was again like one of the programs that I got hired on a lot when I was coming up in Canada. And the concept of it is basically two comedians must debate a topic that is usually quite banal. So like some of my favorites that I've done are like cupcake versus muffin, or like buttons versus zippers, cake versus pie, these sorts of things. It's good to talk to strangers. It's bad to talk to strangers. All kinds of stuff. And so you'll be given a topic and you'll be matched up with another comedian. And then the exercise is to write an opening and a closing argument, which is basically just jokes. And so it really helped me kind of write to a point of view, like a lot of my material, I think, has that, like, I'm kind of making an argument in my jokes. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's where that came from. It's such a great show.
Were you team button or team zipper?
I was team button.
Okay.
For that one.
And what are some of, you know, how do you advocate for buttons?
Well, the technique is all, like, sometimes you have to be pro your time. It's very hard to be, this is what I learned in writing this. It's hard to be positive in comedy, which is what I aimed to do with that popcorn joke in my special. Was like, I was challenging myself to write a joke that was pro something. Because it's very easy to be anti everything. And like my Netflix special.
You're not really. You're just very specific about everyday occurrences. My favorites are, and you can make a little asterisk on your set list here.
Okay.
Your grandparent bit is hysterical. Gift registries, I loved. Chairs around the Thanksgiving table, I fell off the couch.
That's my favorite.
Unbelievable. Your riff on getting married, and one of the first things that happens is your spouse asks you to fetch something which is actually closer to her than to you. And I'm telling you, it's a brilliant. First of all, it's the first time I've ever heard geometry be amusing. and they're all great. But you know, you're not really negative. You're just kind of describing the planet in very specific terms, which is great.
Yeah. Well, thank you. And that's what I'm aiming to do. Mm-hmm. But I think I sometimes come across. But anyway, so the technique usually to go back to the question is, if you have a topic that you're trying to be positive about on Team Button and you can't think of anything good about buttons, you can just come down hard on zippers. Just
say absolutely. All the bad things zippers about are zippers. Noisier.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to get undressed quietly, you know, team button all the way.
Yeah, no
it's
good.
It's easy. So what I sort of took away, you know, you're an observational comic, but you're especially adept at articulating inner dialogues. So when I see people cracking up in the audience about the piece of popcorn that's still stuck in your mouth later that evening as you're trying to sleep, and all of, you know, the minutiae of life that none of us have said out loud because why? So, but then you do, and everyone has had the same thought pattern, you know, especially when you get to the part about counting teeth. Like, why can my tongue find it, but my finger can't? I've never been out, you know, to coffee with the girls where someone, you know, I'm wondering if you share this experience. Have you ever attempted to get a kernel of popcorn? I mean, but you just go for it. So I'm wondering when you know that an inner dialogue is a potential joke.
That is how I do the testing. That's where the lab work comes in.
Because
there's definitely times when I think that something I think about a lot is a common subject that we all share. And then I try it out on stage and audience after audience tells me, no, I'm the only one that thinks like that.
You're the only one.
It's really an experimentation of trying to find the things that people can relate to, but
where did you record popcorn?
Very much.
Where did you record popcorn?
I recorded it in Victoria, British Columbia, which is it's on Vancouver Island. You have to take a ferry to get there. It's quite nice, and I hadn't been there in a couple of years, and it was one of the first cities that I toured to when I started performing stand-up professionally, and I've always had a pretty good turnout there. And so I taped it there because I have a pretty good fan base there, and they came out and they filled it, and we knew we were going to be able to fill two shows on semi-short notice, and I couldn't have been happier. I was really
the audience was in love with you.
It looks really elegant and lovely, and it kind of like suits your style and your branding. It's just, it's very crisp and warm and delightful.
Oh, thank you so much.
You're of the Jerry Seinfeld school, and that is that you're going to work at night, you should dress appropriately. So you have a suit. Jerry always wears a suit. But also, it's sort of an immediate irony because you look like, especially if somebody that doesn't know you, you come out on stage, you look like you're ready to do a PowerPoint presentation at IBM. I mean, you don't look like you're going to slay with these killer observations. And I think that probably works to your benefit.
Yeah, I like to, you know, take people off guard. It is an interesting thing, but I agree with you. Yeah, it's my job, and I want to dress up. It's fun. Like, I was raised, my parents were both kind of like beatniks, and so they my wearing a suit was like my act of rebellion when I was younger. I was like, I just want some structure in my life. Like, everything, they were like, you can swear at home and don't have to do your homework. And I was like, all right.
What does it take to get grounded?
Yeah, let me try and be a normal, let's see what, like, I'm like, I felt like for the first little while, I was just like trying to dress like what a regular human dress is like.
Where did you start?
I started in Vancouver, and I did a few gigs down in Seattle as well. I used to cross the border into Blaine, Washington, and then Seattle, Washington. I would try out material down there. But mostly, primarily, I was coming up in Vancouver, which was a really great scene in the early 2000s. We had a guy who was a sitcom star who had started this really successful room, and the audiences were just very primed. And there was also a lot of shooting. Movies used to get shot in Vancouver a lot back then. And so we would have people like Robin Williams would drop in, and Ben Stiller, like great guests would come in and do these like fun little local rooms. And so the scene was very vibrant, and it was such a magical thing for me as a like little farm town boy to like drive into the big city. And then like, there's Robin Williams doing stand up. Wow. I was like, well, this is incredible.
Well, I would like to hear a little bit more about your hippie parents and when you first realized that maybe stand up comedy was where you wanted to head.
I think it was because, so my parents split up when I was about 8. My dad lived in Vancouver, in the big city. My mom stayed in the town, and that's where I went to high school and sort of grew up. And every second weekend, I would go into the city. And so there was always this kind of, I was also born in Montreal. My parents moved to the small town. That's where my mom's parents lived. And so I was raised, it was this very funny thing where like, I was in the small town, but my mom would constantly be like, you know, in Montreal, nobody would care about this. Or I would have these problems, like small town problems, like, oh, people at school are being mean and stuff like that. And she would be like, oh, don't worry. Like, someday you'll go to a bigger city and it's fine. If no one in your school likes you, that's okay, because it is possible for an entire town to be stupid. She didn't say it like that. It wasn't that mean, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
I'm paraphrasing.
We get the gist.
But that was the vibe that I felt. Like, she was reassuring to me that, like, even if I was not popular, I would be able to find a group if I were to experience a larger culture. And so it was good for me to get to go to the city. So I had this kind of, like, I built up the idea of going to the city in my mind. And then when I was in high school, I had a job and I was just kind of not really doing anything. I was thinking about going to college, but I didn't really know what I wanted to do. And that's when I sort of discovered stand-up. And it was just incredible for someone to get, it was something, somewhere to go, to leave the city or leave my town. And instead of just doing like, we were, you know, when you're like a 20-year-old and there's nothing to do, you're like, ah, let's go somewhere. Yeah. And so it was nice to have a place to go. And there were new jokes being told every night. It was just such an incredible thing to find. And so that was sort of where I fell in, and it kept me focused. It was, you know, there was more stuff, and then you got the fun science of like telling a joke, having it work, having it not work, and then talking to other comedians about that process of what it takes to build a joke, build your first little 5-minute set. I mean, you probably know, Fritz, it's incredible, right? That first feeling, yeah, when you get that first 5-minute chunk.
Well, you
works.
Can listen to your act and know that you're one of those people, I reflect back on Seinfeld, that's very precise about it. There's not an extra word. There's only precise adjectives. And you don't use too many words to describe something that don't require a lot of words. It's really very precise. And you can see the science and the discipline you put yourself through to write. It's very obvious in your act.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, to me, that's the fun, is like trying to find, mm-hmm, how few words can I do to get, mm-hmm, this laugh?
And which words are the most effective?
Yeah, exactly. And funny, too. Like, that's, yeah, a big conversation, mm-hmm, I've had with my friends. I mean, the classic is the hard K sound. In the closing joke of the special, I had an argument with a comedian friend of mine, because he's a writer. He writes, he's an author. And he was saying, logically, it's funnier to say, you know, what's harder than a long-distance relationship is a no-distance relationship. And then I was like, yeah, I have to say close-distance relationship, because it's,
right,
it has a hard K, yeah, mm-hmm, sound. It's funnier. And I tried both.
Yeah, it's also like making up a term is fun too.
Yes. Oh, yeah. To me, that's very fun.
You just got married shortly before you taped the special. Is that? Am I getting the timing right? Or
Yeah. Yeah, we had been married about a year, and we had just had a baby. Our baby was he was about 6 months old.
Oh. He makes an appearance.
Yeah, he's in the intro,
which you'll get to show him, which will be really cool. What lines do people quote back to you? Because that is how you know what to put on your merch.
Oh yeah, they quote the piano bench. A lot of people like the reference to the piano bench.
We didn't even have a piano.
Yeah, they let's see. Oh, they also quote back the creepy raisin, shriveled up creep coming around the corner.
Yeah, you like to write about food, and you like to write about sort of shared experiences. And maybe unspoken shared experiences. A lot of them are around food because maybe we don't believe it's worth bringing up to a friend. But the whole thing that you go into, the inner dialogue of someone handing you a cup instead of making you a drink, you know, some of that stuff is just very relatable because everyone's sort of been there and everyone's had these defiant thoughts and then you articulate them. It's kind of a release for everyone to hear you say the things that they've all been thinking.
Oh yeah, thanks. Yeah, I like talking about food because it is one of those things that kind of it's not triggering, you know? There's not really going to be anything that I can talk about. You know, if you talk about food, that's sort of it's in the middle. It's not going to make anybody.
You don't talk about politics.
Not really. No. I mean, I've tried and it's just to me I want to give people an opportunity to sort of escape from that.
Precisely the same philosophy I have about it, which is, first of all, from a selfish standpoint, current events material, it has a very short shelf life, so you have to be writing all these new jokes all the time. But second of all, in this world we're living in with this chasm between thought processes, I just want to take people out of their heads for an hour and make them not think about what they think about for the rest of their week that scares the hell out of them.
Couldn't have said it better myself. Yeah, absolutely.
It's interesting to observe how quickly any conversation, social conversation devolves or evolves into political policy and politics. And so to know, you don't have to be with somebody very long, you know, for it to go in that direction and for someone to kick you because there's someone at the table who has a different stuff talking. It's hard, you know, it is hard not to talk about something that's sort of looming, you know, in this space that we're in right now. It's sort of looming and oppressive. And so to know that you're going to watch a comedian and you can bring everybody in the family and it's not going to go there is really comforting. And the art of doing what you do and creating an act that's such a, you know, a release, because laughter feels so good. And it lets you kind of, you know, hit your friend and say, yeah, you know, especially when you know that this person is especially going to, you know them well enough to know they're really going to relate to what he's talking about. And you must look out at the audience and see them doing all of that.
Yeah, I love that. I love when I see people elbowing. The dishes joke is my favorite for that, when I get to see who the dish people are and the cook people are, and they start elbowing each other. And
there's no show that showcases a competition between the dish people. It's just hysterical. You take the concept and milk it for every single comedic thought. Who are your heroes coming up? Who are your comedy heroes?
I was a big fan of Brian Regan, Jim Gaffigan, Seinfeld as well. And, you know, a lot of those sort of touring acts. It's funny because I didn't have, you know, we had a pretty limited access. Like, we didn't have HBO. So I just had whatever was on cable. So I had Just for Laughs reruns that were on a CTV channel, which was like our kind of national broadcaster, sort of like our CBS, I guess. And they would show like old galas and just, you'd see the short 5-minute clips. Mm-hmm. And so I saw like Wendy Liebman, and I saw Canadian acts too. Mike McDonald is great. Mm-hmm. Norm McDonald as well. Also Canadian legend. And so any of those shorter sets, but then the people who I sought out, when I was starting out in comedy were definitely the more observational style. Seinfeld, I watched a lot of. Chris Rock, I was a huge fan of. He was really popular at that time. And
you know, Brian Regan has turned out to be a great actor. Have you seen Loudermilk, the series?
Yes.
Man,
it was filmed in Vancouver, and so was it
really? I'll tell you. First of all, I love the show because there's, you know, recovery all over my family. But second of all, Brian Regan, I think the last one I watched was like episode 8 in the first season, where it's pretty much about him and he goes off the wagon. He's a great actor. I'm hoping that he gets more work out of this. I think he will. He really showcased his talent.
Yeah, I hope so too. It was so nice to see him in that different environment.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of your longer term goals? Do they bend towards acting or hosting your own show, or what's the dream?
I've always thought it'd be fun to host a show. I'm a big fan of the Great British Baking Show, and I thought it'd be very fun to get to do something along those lines.
The dishwashing show at long last.
Oh man.
Yeah, I mean, if it ever comes to fruition, they got to at least let me audition.
Well, if you had to make your own steel wool, I think it would get more interesting at that point.
Yeah, it's like a blacksmith style show. Dude, I don't even know how you'd make steel wool. Like, I guess,
does anyone?
Do you turn wool into steel, or do you turn steel into wool? Which way? I don't even know where you start.
Therein lies the intrigue.
Yes.
Yeah, no.
You're a host waiting to happen. You'd be great at that.
You're the hostiest. Oh, yeah. No, you should definitely be hosting, like, pronto. Now, what are comedians in your group of coming up? What do you guys talk about in terms of social media, TikTok, presenting yourself, how much of your stuff to give away, how much to keep for your stage act? Like, what do you guys talk about? What's the strategy?
Yeah, it's all so different now. I mean, it was definitely when I started, it was you gotta get on television, you know, back in 2006, 2007. Mm-hmm. It was still, TV was king, and then social media sort of came across. And I've had some friends who've achieved some success online. And part of the reason why this special that I just did, why Popcorn is on YouTube, is for that reason, because anybody can access it. It's not about the special itself making me any money specifically from the special. But I would like to reach a wider audience and get to perform live. To me, I'm very much like, I want to earn the money coming to the town and doing the show. And so I'm definitely not of the mind that, like, I'd like to sit back and just collect checks and not have to do this anymore. I love stand up. And so to me, the big goal with it is, yeah, try to get enough of a following that I can start going city to city and doing shows where I have an audience of my fans. It's such an interesting shift when you start to see your fans in the crowd versus sort of the typical regular club comedy club crowd. Not that there's anything wrong with it. Anybody that comes out and supports comedy, I love them, but there's a skepticism when they don't know you that you have to sort of punch through. Right. And once you're performing for your fans, it's great because you can sort of cut a lot of the, you know, more banal jokes or like little intros.
And they
things,
have your you viewpoint know. Before they walk in the building. They know what to expect.
Yeah, it's fantastic. You should come out and be yourself immediately. Mm-hmm. And it's just very comfortable. It's like going to dinner with family as opposed to meeting people you haven't met before. Mm-hmm. And so to me, that's the big goal. And so, yeah, I think now my colleagues and I, we just talk about like, yeah, put everything out. Put everything out and put everything out twice. You don't even have to worry about posting the same video over again. Like, it's kind of a very strange, it's so counterintuitive to like everything I was taught growing up. And I think there's definitely a difficulty for the older generation of comedians to be told this. I mean, the first time I met with my label, it was very funny because it was one of the best things I've ever heard. We had a Zoom meeting. We were going to talk about doing the special and an album. And they were like, oh yeah, sorry, we were late to the meeting. We were just explaining TikTok to Bob Newhart.
No.
Oh, that's funny. That's very funny.
And I was like, did he love it? And they're like, he did not understand it, and I don't think he cared for it.
Did someone record that Zoom?
Oh, my God, that's funny.
That's gold.
Yeah.
I hope. Yeah, I'd love to hear Bob's take on it, of course. Because he's even further back than me, I'm sure.
No, but he was the one that mastered how important a recording could be. And you'd still go and see Bob Newhart, even if you knew every word on that button-down mind, you would still go. He got it. So he should get TikTok.
He's my absolute, one of my absolute favorites.
Yeah. He's very much like yourself. There's an amazing everyman quality. Everybody relates to his personality. Is there a show in Canada that you could compare to the late night TV shows in the United States where one or two good performances on that show could launch a career, like a late night talk show type thing?
No, they've tried. There's been a few late night show attempts, but it's because we get American television in Canada. It's just it's such a tough thing to compete with. And so unless you're in French Canada, in Quebec, they have their own late night shows and star systems. But my French is not good enough to do comedy. It's not even good enough to order at Starbucks. Mm-hmm. They don't let you. If you go to Montreal and I try to order in French, I'll get two words in. They'll be like, all right, I'll speak English. It's fine.
And speaking of Montreal, you've done the Just for Laughs Comedy Festival, which is like the biggest comedy festival in the world, like 100 venues. And how is that? Because you are Canadian, there must have been a certain amount of pride in being able to master that place.
Oh yeah, it's such a great thing to get to represent Canada and be on these galas with, you know, big stars. I got introduced by Carrie Fisher on one of them. Mm-hmm. It was just such an incredible experience to get to do that. And you know, that organization also takes Canadians all over the world. I performed in Bermuda with Just for Laughs and in Australia, and so it was very cool. I got to do the Sydney Opera House thanks to them.
Wow.
And so I've really been very fortunate that that they've helped me as much as they have.
Wow, that's so exciting, and I bet your hometown is very proud of you.
Yes, yes. It's very sweet to get to go back, and you know, there's a few. Will Sasso of Mad TV is also from my hometown.
Really?
And so there's a few of us.
I'm surprised that show's not on, because on any given night, they were funnier than Saturday Night Live.
They had some great sketches.
Yeah. So
there's also an MLB pitcher that was in my high school too. And my Netflix aired, I was like, this'll be it. I'll make the front page of my hometown paper for sure. And then he threw a no-hitter against the Blue Jays while playing for the Yankees. And I was like, well, there's no way. I'm in the back of the paper now.
I am outraged. How dare he?
But we're all very proud of him as well.
Did you know the guy?
Yeah, it was funny because I didn't really watch baseball. My wife is a big baseball fan, so she introduced me to the sport. And his name is James Paxton, and he was pitching for the Yankees. He started out, he used to be on the Mariners, and we were watching a Mariners game because her family are all from Ontario, big Blue Jays fans. And I saw this pitcher on the mound, and I was like, where do I know this guy from? Did he used to be on our team? And then they said that he was from Ladner, and I was like, oh, I know him from the hallway of my high school. That's why I know his face.
Tell us about Ladner. I want to hear, you know.
It's a much bigger town now than it was when I was growing up, late 80s, early 90s. It was sort of a suburb, but it was separated from the city by a tunnel that went under the river. And so to get into the city, you had to go under a tunnel and over a bridge, which we all know there's a term for that. But they would drive, you know, I would drive into the city. It's about an hour away from the city. And we didn't have any big, like if we wanted to buy clothes or electronics, like we had to go into the city to do that. And it was mostly farms and fishing boats and stuff. And so if you wanted to get a job when you were in high school, you could get a job. My brother did it. I never did it because I get motion sick. But you can get a job.
That's bad.
Just standing on the back of a boat gutting fish for 2 weeks straight.
Mm.
It's horrible, but then you come back and you get to buy a truck. And so that was the whole thing. It's like you go away. People would come back to school in September and have a nice new truck. And they'd be like, I did the fish gutting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you said your parents were hippies, but how did they draw employment? What did they do for a living?
My mom was an artist. She was a visual artist. And now she's sort of moved into the audio artist space. She does a lot of great stuff there. And my dad worked as a generator operator for movie sets. So he was involved in the film industry in Vancouver. And so he got to do a lot of be on set. And that was a kind of a cool thing, too, when I was younger. I got to go to the sets and sort of see like behind the scenes in all these big studios that he would work at in Vancouver.
So they were supportive of you launching out into a career where your soul could be crushed on any given night, and They were supportive of you? They knew you were
sickeningly
good.
Supportive.
Good. Really... I'm so happy to hear that.
They were always so sweet, and they would come to shows, and whenever family was in town, you know, they would come and show. My dad's mom, my 92-year-old grandma, used to come and see me every time.
Do you have any siblings?
I would go through. I do. I have two brothers. I'm the middle child.
Okay, so three boys. So that is an especially competitive environment. Were you all funny, or were you competing for laughs?
We were all pretty funny. Yeah, I never think of myself as particularly funnier than any of my brothers. I just chose to make a career out of it and sort of figure out the editing process of stand-up. I think base level funny is like, anybody has it. Stand-up is like, once you figure out how to take words out and put new ones
in. Yeah, it's science at that point, like you said earlier.
Have you thought about or had to reckon with the concept of doing a joke about somebody who might not be pleased that they're in the joke or that this part of your relationship has been revealed?
Definitely. Yeah. And it was a big thing with my wife. When I got married, I was like, I never want to be a negative wife comedian.
Mm-hmm.
And even some of the jokes in my act were sort of starting to trend that way. The fight wine joke, it was her idea to be like, no, say I'm ramping up. Because I didn't want to be like, my wife gets mad. But she was like, no, it's fine. It's good. It's funnier. It's better if you do it that way.
And now it's a closer.
Yeah.
Do you take your family on the road with you?
Sometimes, yeah. If it's somewhere nice. I've taken my wife and son down to LA a bunch, and we went down to San Diego a little while ago. That's always fun.
Is she Canadian or American?
She's Canadian.
Like, you're the only two things she could be. She's Canadian?
Yeah.
Okay. It's a binary choice.
No, she's Romanian, and you insulted me. Right?
No, she's from up here, from Canada as well. And so, she's been great. But definitely, if I'm ever talking about anybody on stage, I always want to run it by them first.
Because that will happen at some point with your child.
Yes.
But at first, they'll want to be in the joke, and then they will definitely not want to be in the joke.
Yeah, absolutely. I always think of comics whose acts, like someone like Chad Daniels, who's so great, and his kids who have, you can sort of see them grow up through his albums, Gaffigan too. It's like, I wonder if, you know, it's such a weird thing. Like, he's, mm-hmm. they're going to see it eventually.
Yeah, it's paying for the groceries, honey. Keep your mouth shut.
You have exactly. A joke that really works where, you know, he's two, but now he's 20, but you love the joke. You know, so there's that too. Like, I know that guy. His baby is not a baby.
Well, when are you coming down to LA so we can meet you in person?
I will be there soon. I'll be there in April. I usually come down 1 week a month.
Where are you working?
I usually perform at the Comedy and Magic Club out in Hermosa Beach.
Oh, the best. One of the best clubs in America, without question. Yeah.
That's a space that definitely suits you. We love Mike Lacy.
Yeah,
Mike is fantastic. Richard's great. All the staff down there are just so wonderful. Yeah. Bill, too. Yeah. They're just so great. And when I first moved down there, they were so accommodating and nice, and I was so lucky to get in with them.
Mm-hmm.
Anytime I go there, it feels like coming home. So they're just fantastic.
And they really feed the comedians.
Man, you don't eat any better anywhere. I've gone down there just to get a free meal without even performing.
If you want to go out.
I'll have the prime rib, and if you have 5 minutes, I'll do it for you.
No, I'm just telling you, if you want to go out for dinner and see comedy, go to the Comedy Magic Club, because that is the best food of any comedy club in Southern California.
Oh, yeah.
So what would you like for folks to know in terms of finding your content before we wrap it up?
Oh, yeah. If you want to follow me on Instagram, it's at Ivan W. Decker. That's where I post clips and new material and sort of links to my dates where I'll be performing, all that kind of stuff can be found there, and also on my website, ivandecker.com. But the main thing is I want people, you know, I don't want you to come and see me without having seen what I do. So please watch my special, Popcorn. It's on YouTube. There's a link to it on my website and on my Instagram, or you just go into YouTube and type Popcorn Ivan Decker and it should come up.
Yes, and we will have all of this additionally in our show notes. So if you weren't able to write down what Ivan said while you were driving, don't worry. Just get home and take a look at the show notes, and it will all be there.
You have a gift, my friend. I'm glad I got to meet you. You are really, really good.
Oh, thank you so much. That's so kind.
You are.
I really appreciate you having me.
You're excellent, and we cannot wait to watch your career develop from here. Fantastic getting to speak with you, Ivan. Thank you so much. Here come our closing credits. Thank you so much for joining us. We would love to continue this conversation with you on Instagram and Twitter, where we are at MediaPathPod, and on Facebook, where our show page is MediaPathPodcast, and our Facebook group is MediaPath with Fritz and Wheezy Podcast Community. You can find full video podcast episodes loaded with bonus visual content on our YouTube channel, MediaPathPodcast. We would love it if you would judge our appearance and then maybe subscribe even. You can write to us at mediapathpodcast@gmail.com. We want to know about your media path. What have you been enjoying? If you enjoy the show, please give us a nice rating wherever you get your podcasts and share our social media posts so that your friends can learn about your excellent taste in podcasts. Our website, MediaPathPodcast.com, is a great place to browse around and find interesting episodes that you may have missed. We also have a fun and sassy newsletter loaded with photos and quizzes and more dish about our guests. All the newsletters are right there for you to enjoy on our website, and you can sign up to get your newsletter sent directly into your inbox, just one per week. We do understand healthy boundaries. We want to thank our guest, Ivan Decker. Our team includes Dina Friedman, John Maddox, Bill Filipiak, Mason Brown, Garrett Arch, Jordan Reyes. What's your last name, Ralph? Ralph Rusek, and you. Our theme music is by me and John Maddox. I am Louise Planker, here with Fritz Coleman and Ivan Decker. Be well and wise, and we will see you along the media path.